are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Orla Shinawee.
Hello, Richard.
And we're joined today, special guest, Bob Varney, runs Drops Team.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
Featured in the first ever cycling podcast Femina a few months ago.
From an underpass in Croydon.
Underpass in Croydon, the glamour, yeah. So we told a bit of the story there of your first season, and you know, we're at the end of the season now, so we'll get a little update from you and look ahead to next year, which I know you're looking to step up. You're also just back from Qatar in the World Championships, so speak to you about that. We're going to cover a lot, as usual. We're going to do the World Championships in part one. Part two, we're going to talk about La Course, the sort of revamped or changed women's race attached to the Tour de France. We're going to hear from Lionel Burney and his retro feature, as usual. We have also got an interview with Kelly Catlin, the American Olympic silver medalist, who's a very interesting character, a classical violinist like Orla, as she tells us.
I was. You look at me as if that's a fib.
I think we're going to need evidence.
A classical violinist.
We're going to need evidence for it at some point.
Note the past tense. I can now manage twinkle, twinkle.
Anyway, Kelly Catlin is also, unlike Orla, a mathematician, a Chinese speaker, a triplet, a unicyclist, and anything else about her?
Training to be a doctor,
yeah. And she's into her mindfulness apparently as
she
well.
She is, yeah, optimal so experience.
She's 20 years old, I think, 19 or 20. She's very young, very talented, and very interesting. So we'll hear from her later on. And then final part, we're going to grill Bob about his experiences this year running the women's team and plans for next year. So Bob, you're just back from Qatar in the World Championships. Really, I mean, the women's road race was a really exciting race. I think a lot of us feared the worst with the World Championships in Qatar. And in the end, we were treated to... There weren't that many spectators there. I think we probably saw you if we studied the screen hard enough by the side of the road. But we were treated to a really thrilling race, I thought. And you had a couple of riders taking part.
Yeah, I went to support a couple of drops riders that were in the GB team, Alice Barnes and Laura Massey. But I also had various other meetings lined up there. So it was a bit of a busman's holiday, really. But first time I'd been to the Middle East. It was a very unusual place, incredibly hot, very unusual place to run a bike race. But I definitely embrace globalisation. I don't think we should be going back there anytime soon. I think the atmosphere was lacking, obviously, with the spectators. But I think the last two races really kind of left us with a good impression. Certainly the men's race on the Sunday, if that wasn't as epic, I mean, we'll remember it as being an epic race. The women's race was very exciting, but reasonably predictable in terms of being a bunch kick. Wasn't predictable with the winner. You know, Kirsten had all the pressure on, and we had I wouldn't say a surprise winner, but you know, obviously not one of the favourites.
Amalie Didericsen, the Danish rider, am I pronouncing her name
Didericsen,
right?
I think it is, yeah.
You gave me some lessons in that earlier, Orla. She rode exceptionally well, though. I mean, as you say, Kirsten Wild was the big favourite. I thought the Dutch rode a really interesting race. They were very aggressive quite early on, as if they were wanting to get somebody into one of the breaks, and they had a lot of other strong riders in the race.
They had plenty of cards to play, didn't they?
They
had to control that race, really, or at least try to, didn't they? I mean, they had a full complement of riders. They had, on paper, the strongest team, so they really had to control it.
Yeah, they were the strongest, not only on paper, but on the road. Mm. And they obviously wanted to try to make the opposition teams work, which they tried, but they didn't really succeed, did they?
No, I mean, watching the commentary with David Miller in particular, he's noted the amount of times that, you know, the Dutch riders, Marianne Vos and people like that were being very aggressive and trying to force a split, but there was no counter-attack coming. They're often countering themselves, in fact, with Van der Breggen or somebody, and it maybe needed another team to be equally as aggressive to really force a split at that point.
I mean, there was a standoff really until the end, and I want to play devil's advocate. I don't think it was an exciting race. I think that the last lap was brilliant. I think there was enough to keep us going, and the commentary team I thought was brilliant. In the version I watched, same as you, David Miller, Rochelle Gilmore and Simon Brotherton, they did a brilliant job. But I think, once again, the women were shortchanged. I really do. I think laps and laps of what was a big old crit, essentially. If you're watching women's cycling for the first time, honestly, if you sat on your sofa and sat down watching that, would you think, wow, this is a sport that's got me by the scruff of the neck? And
but there's not much. There weren't. Interestingly, Mark Cavendish said about the men's race that it would have been just as exciting had it been 50 kilometres shorter. So I don't think the length is the issue.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
It's the terrain, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the terrain. And we all have our suspicions as to why the race was held there. But I think that at least with the men's race, it went out into the desert.
There was wind.
And there was a possibility, which came about, of crosswinds. But I think with the women's race, it was a case of, well, we've already chosen the men's race. We'll just do a shorter version, and that will do for the women. Now, the men's race was never going to be ideal for an epic race. I think the end of it was fantastic, and we were lucky with the crosswinds. But with the women's race, I think it was always going to play out, like you say, Bob, with a bunch sprint. And the permutations of that are incredibly interesting when you know the characters involved and you know the races involved. But most people still don't when it comes to women's cycling, and if that is your advert for the sport, and it's one of the best that we've got because it is televised, it does get an equal footing with the men's race, similar to the Olympics, which only comes once every 4 years, I think that it's, I mean, if you're sitting there on a Saturday afternoon, you've had a big lunch, you're maybe snoozing off a glass or two of wine or a slice or two of cake in my case, it's a perfect accompaniment, but it's not going to waken you up until the last lap.
A couple of things there. First of all, I think it was a much harder bike race than it might appear on the TV, talking to the girls and talking to the riders. You know, it was a very, very tough race. So you're talking about expecting counterattacks to go over the top of moves when they come back. Yeah, it's really easy to see that when you're kind of sitting on the TV or in a bar and you're screaming at the TV, go on, go now. But, you know, the girls were actually nailed to the floor at that point. No one could go or else they would have gone. So, you know, chatting to the GB riders at the end of the race and the next day, you know, when they're obviously had time to reflect upon it, all of them said how hard the race was.
And I don't dispute in any way that the girls raced their hearts out and that it was an incredibly difficult race, the heat, everything. But, we had nothing. We had no features other than the riders and the terrain. There was nothing to split it up. We had not even a sniff of a hill. I mean, like I say, it was always going to be that way. But I think for World Championships, it's simply unfortunate that it's left to the riders and the politics and the tactics of the teams, which are fascinating if you know the sport. But if you don't, it's very difficult to watch that.
It's pretty cool that we have different World Championships, that suit sprinters, etc., etc. You know, Cav was disappointed he didn't win on Sunday because he knew it was his last chance. Mm. But that also goes for Kirsten Veld, doesn't it? You know, she'll never get another chance to be world champion. So it's good that we have those opportunities. The UCI only went there for money. That's obvious, which is not necessarily a bad thing if it's invested back into the sport in the right ways. And I suspect that may not be the case, but that's another argument entirely. But the bike race was hard. It would have been harder if it had been out into the desert, and that would have been ideal.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think it was an interesting race. I watched it as I watched the Olympic road race after I knew the result. And it's always really interesting watching a race when you know the result. When you first spot the eventual winner and what the kind of favourites teams are doing and so on. And I was very impressed despite the fact they didn't win, by the Dutch team's plans, the way they tried to execute the plan and by their professionalism and their organisation at the end. And it's always, you know, a big sort of thing at a World Championships, how do you get riders from rival teams to work together? You know, and there's always a suspicion that a rider, Marianne Vos, multiple world champion, leading out Kirsten Veld. You know, to see that, I thought was really impressive. The six-woman train leading out Kirsten Veld, I haven't seen that very much in women's cycling, really, that level of organisation.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that for me, one of the highlights was the women's junior road race when the Italian team got it absolutely bang on. You know, they didn't try and hit the front with 7K to go or 5K to go. You know, they got the entire team on the front with 3K to go, which is perfect. And they delivered, you know, you can't fault it, 10 out of 10. And then the team spirit among the team when they all sang the national anthem at the end. You know, that was one of the most, well, probably the most uplifting experience from the women's side of the whole week.
I'm really glad you mentioned Marianne Vos as well, because I think she deserves a huge mention. I mean, anyone who watched that race and saw the lead out that she gave to Kirsten Veld, she has done everything she needs to do for King and Country, for career. We've mentioned in previous podcasts that she's almost passing the baton on, her allowing almost the younger generation to come through. And I think the lack of ego that she shows by not just leading out, but doing it with such passion and dedication is really phenomenal. And I think that she is just such a classy athlete that it deserves to be mentioned.
She did a similar job at the Olympic Games, really.
Going
quite early, set up Van Vleuten and ultimately Anna van der Breggen. You know, she played a similar sort of role there. The British team as well, you mentioned Rhoda, they also clearly had a plan. Danny King put in a pretty ferocious attack towards the end, which did seem to split up the field a bit.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
I should point out that we're in the Rafa Cafe. Our sponsors, Rafa, are hosting us. Don't know if they
spiritual
know
spiritual home.
That they're hosting us, but we're in their cafe in Soho, so that explains the sort of hubbub in the background.
I like how you say you don't know if they know that we're here. We're sitting here with
now.
Brightly coloured microphones,
pretty
speaking rather loudly
pretty
in the corner.
Pretty inconspicuous. Speak for yourself, Orla.
And I think they've clocked us.
No energy balls today, Orla. No funny coffee. But
just pure caffeine.
Two double macchiatos.
Yeah, I already had a coffee before I left. I'm still fueled on nuts, though. Nuts, my energy of choice. Butter this morning.
I hope you don't peak early. I hope you've still got something left for part five when we're grilling Bob about drops.
I'll get some help.
Let's carry on with the World Championships. We haven't really spoken about the winner, Diederichsen. You're good at pronouncing her name.
Well, I just
Bob's just going to call her Amelie.
Absolutely, yeah. You'll all think I know her then.
But again, watching the race, knowing the result, it was really interesting to watch her and seeing just at what point she attached herself to Kirsten Wild's wheel. And it was similar to the men's race where Mark Cavendish really glued himself to Peter Sagan's wheel and in doing so did the right thing, ultimately made probably a mistake not following him. But I mean, she's 20 years old, Diederichsen. She showed real maturity there. That was the wheel that everybody wanted, especially with the lead out that Wild had. And I thought she looked like a bit like Cavendish in the finish, the way she got very low down over the bars, head very low, and a very classy result. I mean, Wild is one of, if not the best sprinters in the world.
Tour of Qatar winner.
She had a brilliant lead out. As you say, it was her best chance to become world road race champion. And Diederichsen was a very good winner. As you pointed out, Bob, I mean, she's a former junior world champion, 2013, 2014, and 2016 she's a senior world champion.
It's impressive, isn't it? Mm. Really impressive. The finish did kick up a bit.
It
wasn't that noticeable on TV. The head-on shot probably showed it a little bit. But it did kick up, and I think that if you look at the results of the previous races, it would be easy just to go a little bit too early.
I think, we mentioned her age, she's just 20, but as you say, two-time junior world champion. She showed such incredible racing nous, didn't she? I mean, she's clearly a very clever rider. She's got experience beyond her years. And it was very Cavendish-esque. She knew what she had to do with a small team around her. And I thought it was interesting that Kirsten Wild afterwards said that her lead out possibly started too early. I mean, she conceded quite rightly that Diederichsen was simply the better rider on the day. She pipped her fair and square. But I think that's sometimes a disadvantage, isn't it? Whenever you've got a very strong team around you, everyone is expecting you to do the work, as indeed the Dutch team did, and you're relying on your teammates an awful lot, and maybe you're sticking to a plan rather than going with your gut instinct. Diederichsen had no choice but to simply bury her head and try to get to the line first. And I think that maybe stood against Kirsten Wild, possibly not.
Well, the Dutch obviously had their plan A. They had obviously plan B and plan C, which, they tried to make the race earlier on, split it up a bit, get some moves away, which ultimately didn't happen. So, they're then with their plan A. Well, their plan A doesn't get a lot better than Kirsten Wild in a flat sprint like that, does it? You look at Yorkshire, you look at the Ride London Classic. She was definitely the wheel to be on. And that's where the race was won. When Diederichsen got onto her wheel, she was in the best place to be to win the bike race. And then she had the legs to deliver, didn't she? Now, let's have a look at Lizzie. Let's have a look at the GB team. GB team rode really, really well. They had a plan. They had Hannah Barnes was being aggressive near the end. Danny King was absolutely immense. How cool was that to see Danny King riding for GB in such a way? And when she did her last pull into that last dead turn, that was really very important for Lizzie. And given another day, we could be talking about Lizzie and Cav. The margins are very, very fine. If Lizzie had got onto Kirsten Wild's wheel, she had the legs to come off and win. But so I think that's where she won the race, when she was the when she got on to Kirsten Wild's wheel.
Did Ericsson, has she been on your radar at all this year? Is she a rider that you've noticed and clocked at all in the racing this year?
No, to be honest. I could give you the smart answer, but she's obviously very talented. And she
will be now.
Well, she's on the best team in the world, isn't she, with Danny Stamm at Bowles Dolmans. She's certainly out of our league, but she was in the UCI lounge on the Sunday, walking around very normally, casually dressed. You would never realise that she was, world champion.
You say given another day, it could have been Lizzie Deignan's day, but I think given another course, given another year, it could well be next year. And that was one thing that she pointed out after the race, was she was so excited by how Team GB rode. Such a young, fresh team, so many of them new to the World Championships, certainly on the road, at Danny King being a case in point. And I think that the promise they showed was really exceptional. And I think as well, in Lizzie, they now know that they've got a very strong leader, and she has really accepted that leadership role, as of course you would imagine, having now been world champion. But I think it shows an awful lot of promise. Women's cycling in Britain looks to be in a very strong place after those world championships.
I think the really interesting thing is that she has a 2-year deal with Bowles. So, that's 2016. Then we've got 2017. When's Yorkshire? 2019? 18.
She'll be a drops rider by then.
Well,
2019.
Never say never, Richard.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring cycling podcast Femina. Very grateful to them for not kicking us out of their cafe yet. We'll just have to keep buying coffees, I guess.
I'm going to make it an aim to be kicked out of the cafe. Sounds fun.
Anyway, we're going to move on to La Course. We're speaking in the week that the Tour de France route for 2017 has been announced. And buried in that announcement was the news that La Course, which the last couple of years has been a circuit race on the Champs-Élysées on the final day of the Tour for women, is now something else. And there had been rumours that it was going to be expanded into a 3 or 4 day race. Those rumours have proved unfounded, sadly. And instead, we've got a race that finishes halfway up the Col d'Izoard on the Thursday in the morning, we guess, before the men race to the top of the climb. The women are doing just the first 10 kilometres. And it's not met with a very positive reaction, I think it's fair to say. Nicole Cook has been one of those who's complained on Twitter about it, calling it a real step backwards. That reaction is entirely understandable. And I don't know what you think, Bob, but there were certainly problems with La Course, I think, and we were quite critical of it as a showcase for not just for women's racing, but for any racing. It has similar issues to, a circuit race in Qatar. It's just not challenging enough. This is challenging, but it's a 66-kilometre race halfway up a mountain. Is that a step forward, or is it a step sideways, or is it a step back?
It's probably the most disappointing news we've had all year, isn't it? When you think that the progress that's been made in the women's side of the sport has been phenomenal this year. And I think there were so many people that were on the edge of their seat. They couldn't wait, for the announcement. Bated breath, what's it going to be? It's hugely disappointing.
I mean, you'll be wanting to take a team there next year regardless. I mean, that, I guess it's a race that you'll want to feature on your calendar.
You say regardless, we'd need to give that some thought, I think.
Well, it's a huge investment of time and effort to get to South of France for a 66 kilometre race halfway up a mountain.
Yeah, we would really like to have gone this year. We weren't fortunate enough to get an invitation. We did apply, but we have ridden in 10 countries this year, and we've ridden in France. But we need to look at the logistics, and we need to spend our money wisely. And we do like to support sort of race organisers that have supported us. And on social media, I read coming in this morning a comment about the women's peloton going up crowd-lined climbs. Well, when you've got the Tour of Flanders, and I mentioned to you earlier when we went up the old Clermont, it was absolutely packed solid with fans. That was as a prelude to the men's race, which is not always the way we want things. We want to maintain the women's classics like Vergada that we spoke about, where there is no men's race. So for the La Course to be so short, not go to the top, I'm sure there are logistical issues with trucks and stuff, but it's not beyond organising to have the race the next day and then organise a stage somewhere on the Saturday between there and Paris, and then have the third and final stage on the Sunday. You know, I can't see that it would be that difficult for ASO to organise if they really wanted to.
There's certainly a lot of France between there and Paris, and, yeah. And you know, that slot on the Champs-Élysées is still available.
I just don't understand it. I frankly don't understand it. And I think it's a real shame that, on the one hand, ASO and the UCI are heralding this as a great advance forward for women's cycling and yet not explaining how. No details really of the stage. And it's just swapping a sprinter stage for a climber stage, which, okay, that's fine. It shakes it up, but it's not doing anything more than that. I mean, we asked for reaction on Twitter, and to a man and a woman, every reaction was negative. I've got one here from at DJCC_coach who has suggested something similar to you, Bob, saying increase women's racing to the last 4 days, mountain stage, rolling stage, individual time trial, and the Champs-Élysées final, a mini stage race. I mean, that just seems so obvious that that has to be the aim. That has to be the target, surely.
Shall I read a few more tweets out from people? Philip Goose said, if anything, won't this lead to fewer live viewers? At least the Champs-Élysées guarantees footfall. Not impressed with one stage. Neil Buckley says, a 41-mile race, not even finishing on a summit. It's a step back for sure. Adam Ronnie, no step forward. Another cop-out, 6-7 kilometres is a joke.
It's the most disappointing news of the year, isn't it? Really?
Important to say, it's not the UCI on this occasion. It's certainly ASO. You know, they hold all the cards here. And
the reason I mentioned UCI is because Tracy Godfrey was on Twitter saying that.
But they do have
was
minimum race distances, of course.
Mm.
UCI are the governing body. They do set the rules.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about footfall. I think the problem with Paris is our colleague Brendan Gallagher tweeted last night and said that it gets lost in Paris, and it does somewhat. The journalists haven't quite made their way from the penultimate stage yet. Paris is just generally busy anyway. Do people stop and take enough notice? I'm not sure. The advantage of a mountain stage is it tends to be closed. The roads close quite early, so fans get up there nice and early. So we will have people there. But it'll be really interesting to see what happens with TV, with external coverage. I am a bit baffled by it. I don't understand it. And as quite a few people on Twitter also pointed out, anyone who decides to enrol in the Étape du Tour a week earlier, any females riding that, which is, of course, the amateur sportive, they will end up riding a tougher course than the professional woman. And I'm sorry, that cannot be a good signal to send out.
Isn't it? Quite ridiculous.
Someone else on Twitter, and this maybe is a different discussion, someone says, perhaps a discussion of why the women demand a greater part of the Tour de France instead of working to build the Route de France or a women's Tour de France. You know, is that a more workable plan to establish a race like the women's tour here in Britain that's separate and standalone?
Well, we were talking about that earlier, weren't we, when we mentioned Vergada and obviously the women's tour. Personally, I think that's my preference, although I can see the PR value of Liège-Bastogne-Liège and Amstel Gold and the engagement with cycling fans across the world. I know there's a lot of excitement about those races, but you know, let's also spare a thought for the race organisers that have been treated quite shabbily by the UCI, that have had existing races, that have got sponsors that have committed to women's cycling way before it kind of come trendy. You know, let's just spare a thought for those races that are being moved.
Because there is a long-established German race that has had to move dates because it clashes with the revised La Course, and I'm not sure which is preferable. And I think as well, if we're talking about whether the women should be working towards their own race, I think that's quite separate. I think the point here is that ASO can send out a very strong message as to just how highly or otherwise they rate women's cycling, and I think that's the opportunity that's been missed here. I think, yeah, sure, women should be going for their own race, but the world's sporting media are there at the Tour de France. It is the one bike race of the year that captures an audience far beyond the traditional cycling base. That's your chance, really, to showcase how exciting women's sport cycling can be.
Flanders seemed to get it right this year. You know, the women rode 140k, 10 cobbled climbs, lots of spectators. They even cut away from the men's race for the women's finish live that Lizzie won. So, although it wasn't perfect, it was certainly a step in the right direction. Whether we're, you know, going forward, I don't think we should be aspiring to have a women's race for every sort of male race.
Well, all I can really say at this stage is, whatever happens, whatever, however it's organised, the Cycling Podcast Femina will be there to cover it. I promise. Well, we'll have somebody there on the ground.
Yeah.
Maybe Orla. Wah, wah, wah. We've reconvened, Orla, a few days after we recorded this month's podcast, Feminine, because we were recording just hours after the course for La Course had been announced, and there was a lot of speculation or assumptions made that the La Course was going to finish at a different point to the men's race, as we just discussed. However, it would appear, thanks to some bit of digging done by our colleague, Kayleigh Fretz for Velo News, that it will finish at the same point as the men's race.
Yeah, which is good, at least. We will get the spectacular views that we'd hoped for. And it takes away, I guess, any of our baffling queries as to why it wouldn't be in the same place. However, most of the criticism of the course wasn't necessarily that it didn't finish at the summit. That was just confusing more than anything else. The criticism really was on the duration of it, 67 odd kilometres, and the fact that we had been hoping and widely expecting the race to be extended by a couple of days, and instead it simply switched from Paris to the mountains. Neither of those two things have changed. It's still not quite good enough, I think, as a showcase for women cycling. So yeah, it's great that we'll get the views. It clears that up, but lots of the rest of criticism still stands, I reckon.
I think part of the reason for the confusion as well is that although the Tour de France has been over the Col des Oies many times, there's never been a stage that's finished there. So we weren't sure exactly where the stage was going to finish. The men's and the women's races are going to finish at the Casse des Oies, which is really, it'll be a spectacular backdrop to the stage. It's a stunning place. Starts in Briançon, loops down to the south and then climbs the Izouard from the south. So it's a pretty familiar way to ascend the climb, and you know, it is a very tough climb and it will be spectacular. But as you say, the main complaint, and there's been quite a backlash about it, is over the distance. You know, and I guess that will play out over the coming weeks and months. I think ASO will certainly be, I think they felt that this was represented some kind of progress, some positive step, but I think they'll be pretty aware now, and we'll try to put this question to Christian Prudhomme, the Tour de France director, at some point. They'll be very aware that a lot of people are not very happy about it.
Yeah, and I think what it might do is possibly create more of a demand for more racing for women cycling, because it should be a really great day of racing. Paris tends to be a little bit dull. It's chaotic, yeah. Lots of crashes, that makes for great drama. It doesn't necessarily make for great racing. However, women's racing compared to the men's, smaller teams, much less controlled. We may see an awful lot more attacks going off the front. It could be a much more dynamic race than the men's race. So it could serve as a foil in that respect to the men's racing that will come afterwards. So with any luck, it will be a great day of racing and it will be good to see it on the mountains. And maybe that will lead to more calls for, as I say, an extended race. But whether or not that's listened to, that's a question.
Yeah, and short races can be very spectacular, but this is extremely short. And I'm sure it will be very spectacular. But I think, you know, it's part of the evolution of this thing rather than the end point. So this has just been a little addendum to this month's podcast. Shall we crack on with it now? We're going to hear from Lionel Burney with his retro feature coming up. And then we're going to hear from Kelly Catlin, the young American track cyclist.
With the announcement that Yorkshire will host the Road World Championships in 2019, this month we're looking back to 1982, when the Worlds were last held in Britain. The motor racing circuit at Goodwood in West Sussex was the venue for the road races and the scene for a stunning victory by Britain's Mandy Jones in the women's race. It had been 15 years since Beryl Burton had won the second of her road race world titles, and Britain were not expected to challenge for gold and the rainbow jersey on home soil. Despite the manner of her victory, Mandy Jones was not quite a bolt from the blue winner, because she did have pedigree. She'd finished third behind America's Beth Hyden at Sallanches in the French Alps 2 years earlier, when still only 18 years old. Jones, now known by her married name Bishop, had hoped to win a medal in the individual pursuit held on the track at Leicester a week before the road race. But, as she told Cycling Weekly, she'd overtrained, putting too much effort into motor pacing work in the run-up to the pursuit competition. It meant she was tired and underperformed. She thought she'd blown her chances of a world title and spent the week between the track and the road events riding easy. It meant she was rested for the 61-kilometre road race. Jones lined up with the rest of the British team, Margaret and Catherine Swinnerton, Julie Earnshaw and Pauline Strong, but there was not the same level of organisation and professionalism that the British riders of today enjoy. They were a team in name only, really. They rarely got the chance to race abroad together and compete against the best riders. There was very little funding. They had to provide their own bikes, and kit was sometimes borrowed from the men's team. They were basically amateurs compared to the major nations at the time, the French, the Dutch and the United States. But Jones was talented and competitive. With just over a lap to go in the women's road race, she got away with the Italian Maria Canins, Belgium's Gerda Seerens and Germany's Sandra Schumacher. On the last lap, just as the lead group were taking a breather after a climb, Jones seized an unlikely opportunity. It was on a descent that she led through a corner, realised nobody was coming past her, looked round, saw she had a gap and put her head down and went for it. This was when her ability as a time trialist and pursuer came in handy, and she held off the Italian Canins to win the rainbow jersey. The women's racing scene was underdeveloped at the time, and so the world title was not quite the springboard for Jones that it might be today. She was fourth in the World Road Race the following year in Switzerland, and she did ride the Tour de France Féminin. One year she was fifth overall when a leg injury forced her to withdraw. But there was not the same calendar of elite level races, and so it wasn't a career spent entirely at the top. After having a son in 1986 and sorting out that recurring calf problem that had hampered her, Jones was named in the GB squad for the 1992 Olympics, but injury struck again and she was unable to ride. Mandy Jones is a key figure in British cycling's history. Like Beryl Burton, Tom Simpson and Chris Boardman, she achieved success during eras when British riders largely had to make their own way, and in spite of odds stacked against them. She was inducted into British Cycling's Hall of Fame in 2009. There was a 26-year gap between Mandy Jones's world title and Nicole Cook's in 2008. Since then, Lizzie Armitstead, now Deignan, has also won the world for Britain. Will there be another rainbow jersey to celebrate in Yorkshire in 2019?
Well, first of all, let's start with Rio and the Olympic Games, because obviously you were part of a really thrilling team pursuit final. Now, it was a very young team that you were part of, with the exception, obviously, of Sarah Hammer, your kind of experienced teammate. But tell me about the last sort of 12, 15 months leading up to that, because, you know, I think I've read an interview where you said sort of 18 months ago it was not really on your radar, and you know, it was something that happened quite dramatically. So tell me just about that journey from it being a possibility to you being in Rio and in the final.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting journey. So yeah, probably about 18, 19 months ago, I was a road rider only. I was riding national level events, just kind of an amateur level rider. And I was picked up by a USA Cycling talent ID camp. And I attended that, and that was the first time I rode on the track in late 2014. And then apparently I did well enough, and a few months later they invited me to be a resident at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. That was, I believe, January 2015. So that was the first time I ever rode a track. And I was, yeah, I was told at that point that, I mean, as a resident in an Olympic Training Center, you feel a sense of possibility that you could be on the Olympic team, but it was by no means guaranteed. And from there, we already had Ruth, who's a very, very experienced rider as well, and Jennifer Valente, also has lots of experience on the track. So it was just a matter of like collecting riders from different areas until about 12 months out is when we finally had our team together, our team of five riders.
Wow. And then from there, you went obviously to the World Championships in London and came home with a gold medal. What was that experience like?
That was very odd because, as a lot of people probably noticed, we really weren't expecting that. In the World Cups leading up to the World Championships, we had varying performances. We were improving, but we were trying out new tactics, basically new rider combinations, and that worked out fairly well. And then for some reason, we just hit on something that worked really well at the World Championships and went much faster than we'd ever gone before. So I would say it was surprising more than anything else. It wasn't until after the race that we were like, oh yeah, we rode faster than a 4:16. That was really odd.
I mean, it's the ultimate team event, obviously. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you've got Sarah Hammer there, who's very experienced, and you've got Andy Sparks, who's been a coach for a long time. What's the secret? Is Andy a big factor in that? You've got some very talented young riders like yourself as well. What's the magic in that team? What's the magic formula?
That's a good question. As you mentioned, being a team event, obviously the group chemistry is very important. I mean, so many sports say that, but I would say in particular with such a small group of riders, it's very important. And also the relationship between the riders and the director. It took a while to get the chemistry right, to be kind of united behind one goal. But actually, it was World Championships, I think, that really did that. Once we had that that kind of hope there, it became much easier to settle down and be like, all right, our goal is the Olympics and we're all going to work towards this. Andy and Sarah are also a big part of that. Sarah's very experienced. She's a very grounding presence in training and racing, which is really good. It's like having a coach as one of your own riders, which is can be very helpful at times. And then Andy, of course, is experienced at high-level events and is a grounding presence in his own right.
And then Rio, you were up against a British team that, you know, that's dominated that event and track cycling for a number of years. A very unusual scenario because it was almost a David and Goliath with USA unusually as David, you know, because you're a team that doesn't have the resources that the British team has, you know. And how did that feel going into that final? You must have been aware that it would take probably a world record to win it, but you know, were you thinking we can do this, we can beat this team?
To be honest, in the races, I was never really thinking about the outcome. I would think about it a few moments, like the night before the race. I was like, oh, goodness gracious, it's the Olympics. But other than that, track is nice in that you have so many little tasks to focus on in the hours and minutes leading up to a race. So in some ways, your mind is completely occupied, which is very helpful because you can't be distracted. So for me, it was all about, it's like, okay, this is the warm-up I'm doing. Am I on schedule? Here's my number. Here's my bike. Am I ready? And then you were on the start line and it was all over.
And so, you know, were you pleased with your silver medal? You must have been disappointed to lose the final, but to come home from Rio with a silver medal, was that something you could reflect on with real pride and satisfaction?
Yes, I would say for several reasons. First off, I never expected to be on an Olympic team, particularly for track cycling. And second of all, we still made tremendous gains over the past year or 2 years, which were really impressive. And we still showed that in the final. We did our best, too. So there's nothing you can really be upset about.
Now, you've got a lot else going on in your life. You're one of triplets, aren't you? You've got a brother and a sister.
Yeah, that's correct. They tried to break down my door and come in, but I wouldn't let them.
Are they sporty as well?
Yes, they are. My brother's more of a road cyclist. He's tried the track, but he doesn't want to be too much like his sister. And then my sister used to be a marathon runner until she had knee issues.
And growing up with you know, a brother and a sister the same age, did that lead to a certain amount of competition? I'm getting the sense that maybe there was.
Yes, positive and negative competition. Having siblings that are your age can be tremendously beneficial. You automatically have a friend and an enemy. And positive competition and negative competition. It's very good social training for the real world, yeah.
And I mentioned other things. I know you're studying Chinese and mathematics at university, aren't you? With a view to becoming a doctor eventually. So you want to go on to study medicine?
Potentially, yes. Right now, it's hard to say because getting resettled after the Olympics, I'm rethinking some of my academic plans. I still have the option to take the MCAT, which is a medical admissions test, but I'm thinking perhaps of also taking the GMAT for graduate school admission for mathematics as well. So my summer experiences will probably heavily determine what I do for the future.
You took a year off, I think, out your studies in order to prepare for the Olympics. Is it back to school now?
Yes, I'm taking, 20 credits right now. So yes, it's very much full credits right now.
So how are you managing to train at the moment, and is that really compromising your cycling?
No, actually, it's been really great because instead of training multiple times a day, I'm just training once a day. So it has to be much more efficient, much more quality training. And it's also been a fantastic mental break from studying. So in some ways, it's rekindled my joy for cycling because it's like, yes, I'm done studying. I can go ride my bike.
And tell me about the violin as well, because you're a violinist. Tell me about, you know, how you started and again, if you're still able to keep that up.
Actually, I have my violin right here. It's in this beautiful black case. it's made of carbon fiber. So I have a carbon fiber bike and a carbon fiber violin, of all things.
Did you have that in Rio with you?
I did, actually. I didn't practice as much as my teacher probably would have liked, but I did break it out a few times. I started.
How did you start? Yeah.
Kind of like Chinese. It was something we had kind of an immersion program for orchestra in early elementary school, and everyone else wanted to play the cello or the trumpet, and I was like, nope, not doing that. So I played the violin, and I guess I've stuck with it for no better option for the past 12, 13 years.
Well, I mean, you must be good at it. You're a classical violinist. Does that mean you play in concerts and things like that?
Yes, I played in a symphony orchestra until I left for the Olympic Training Center about 18 months ago. So, yep.
Could it be a career option?
I would say it was until I went to the Olympic Training Center, and then I decided I really like violin, but it's not something I want to pursue as a concert or orchestral musician. So I definitely want to keep it up as a semi-good amateur, but not as a professional.
Is it something, at the... when you're at something like Olympic Games or at training camps, is it something that's good for relaxation, winding down?
That and annoying my teammates, yes.
Did you make yourself quite unpopular in Rio, in the athletes' village?
Well, it's hard to say because they never were brave enough to tell me to stop. So I can pretend that they liked it.
Well, I'm sure, I'm not suggesting it's not a pleasant noise to listen to. It must be quite nice, relaxing for you, relaxing for your teammates as well.
Hopefully, yeah. Hopefully I was skillful enough to not screech too much.
And in terms of sport, you played football or soccer, as you call it, obviously over there. You played football to quite a high level, did you not, as well?
Decently, yes. A semi-national, junior national level, yeah.
So all these options, how, you know, if you're to look at them all, would you say cycling, you know, if you're looking at the next decade, you've obviously got your studies and everything else, but would cycling be, you're an Olympic silver medalist, would cycling be the number one priority?
That's a difficult question. I would say academics will always remain a slightly higher priority for me, just because I guess that's the social environment I've been in since I was very young. It's also what I like to do. I really like sometimes studying. That would remain the highest priority for me.
I read an interesting quote where you said cycling, you compared it to a craft or an art. That was an interesting way of looking at cycling. Why craft or an art?
Because in particular track cycling it's very skill-based. That isn't always obvious to many American viewers when they see the team pursuit, for example. They're like, oh, that looks easy. You're just riding in a circle. But there's definitely an element of skill to it. And the theory behind team pursuit is constantly changing as we get faster and faster. So that part's been really fascinating to me. It's kind of an academic aspect of cycling that's been really engaging to learn new skills and continually develop.
You unicycling as well as another hobby of yours?
Yes, I haven't done that in a while. I haven't done that since I got back from Rio, but I was told not to do it before the Olympics due to potential risk of injury.
So is it just something you like to do around the around where you live, or you know, what? How does it manifest itself, the unicycling? Is it something you do as a practical way to get around or to entertain people? Or
to be honest, it's not super practical because it's about walking speed, unless you have a larger wheeled unicycle, but it's more of a skills thing. There's a club actually in Minneapolis, and we bruise ourselves and bloody ourselves trying to advance our skills.
I mean, I could probably go on forever with this, but you're a writer, and you're quite a good artist as well, is that correct?
Other people might say that, but I don't know if I would.
See, Andy Sparks did warn that you were very modest, but you're a writer. You like to write?
I do, yes.
Where can we see your writing?
Oh dear, that's most of it is anonymous, so I think I'd prefer it to remain that way because I'm a bit bashful about writing because it's a very personal kind of expression of the soul. So you have to be very brave to kind of reveal yourself to a public audience like that.
You're working towards that, I can tell.
Thank you to Lionel Burney for his monthly retro feature. Interesting as ever, Lionel. Thanks for that.
I love Burney's retro features. I really do.
Burney's retro features.
Lionel's, I mean. Sorry, that was very blokey to call him Burney. Instead of Lionel.
Burney. And then after that, we heard from Kelly Catlin, the very talented in many facets of life and the arts and sport. Kelly Catlin. And Orla, you correctly identified the violin music she was playing, because the violin music we heard there was Kelly Catlin herself playing.
She was amazing, wasn't she? I mean,
hang on, you're going to identify the music.
Yeah, they can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was Wieniawski's Violin Concerto No. 2. Maybe the first movement. I think it was the first movement.
You know what? I think you might be right.
I think it might be right.
I think you might be right. Yeah, it certainly sounded like that to me, to my ear.
That's
I don't know
what
about
you, told
you
us
Bob.
It was, anyway.
I'm oblivious to all of this. I didn't understand a word.
But anyway, she's a very interesting athlete, and it'll be good to follow her because she's juggling all these balls, and it, you know, quite big decisions for her in terms of what she focuses on, I suppose. But we hope that cycling will figure there somewhere.
Well, she's still so new to the sport as well. She only took it up.
Yeah, maybe it'll be unicycling. I don't know.
Yeah, one of the two.
But time trialing is clearly something she can do, and she wants to do more road racing. So good luck to her. Now, as I said at the start, we were joined by Bob Varney, who featured his drops team featured in our first ever episode. Also, Abby Van Twisk, you're one of your riders who works not too far from here with her father in his florist. You've had a lot of success. You've really raced, as you mentioned, 10 different countries. You've raced some big races. How do you reflect on it? You know, what's been the biggest lesson you've learned? Because you were sort of quite new to women's racing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot to reflect and ponder on. We don't seem to get a great deal of time to do that, but we did have quite a pleasant couple of hours in the pub. Tom and I last night, going through the UCI calendar for next year. He's come up with stats, which he often does. We've raced in 10 countries. We've done 41 races. We've had 15 riders that have ridden 71 race days, because obviously the 41 races, quite a few are stage races. So 71 days of racing in 7 months. I think that's something to be proud of, really. We keep pressing on. We very seldom give ourselves a pat on the back. But I think we can reflect back on 2016 has been a very special year, and we're very proud of what we've achieved collectively as a team, and we're really very grateful for all the support we've received, you know, not less from yourself, Richard.
Well, you've done a great job of not only running a team but sort of writing a story about yourself. I think a lot of people have become aware of that, the story of the team. And you know, you've been very honest as well about the fact that you're an amateur team. You know, you're not paying the riders, and perhaps there are other teams that aren't quite so honest in that regard. You're underdogs in a lot of respects, so people love an underdog. But has that been part of it, really, to engage with people, to try and get people interested in the story behind the team?
Well, I don't think we've tried to be true to ourselves. We've not really tried to manufacture a story. the stories kind of happen. And no one's more surprised than me, to be honest. Probably my bank manager. But that's another story. One of the nicest things about all of this is the amount of support we've had from really sort of top quality people. Certainly, a lot of women in the peloton are very supportive of our project and the way we conduct ourselves and our honesty regarding payment. Because it's actually really quite shocking the conditions that some of the riders kind of ride under, honest. But not only in women's cycling, in women's sport in general. You know, I've been invited to various women's functions, you know, women in sport. And I was on a table with the team behind Manchester City women's football team, you know. So it's really opened my eyes on all fronts.
Well, we heard from Eileen Rowe earlier, who, you know, has ridden as a professional for a number of years, never been paid, you know, despite riding for some big teams and has to juggle her cycling with her work. When we spoke to you earlier, you were looking for additional sponsorship. Any luck in securing anything for
next
year?
Yeah, we've had some successes. We haven't got the ultimate big one on board yet. We've been announcing some rider comings and goings in the last few weeks. We've still got a couple more to announce in October. We're then going to announce our new sponsorship partners in November. We've announced one already this week on social media because they have an event at Sigma Sport, and that's Naki, the Belgian lotions and potions company. So we're very proud to work with them. They've got a long pedigree and heritage within sport. So they particularly wanted us to announce that. So that was the reason why we've done that. But in terms of sponsorship, seeking sponsors, we had two goals. The first goal was to raise enough, whatever the money it's cost this year, and we're currently adding all the bills up. The first goal was to try to raise the amount that we've invested in the team this year externally next year, so it can continue to the level that we've done this year without me basically signing the checks. We'll put our budget in and be a bit more strict about it. So I think when we did our sums last night, we were about 70-75% of the way to that, and we're still only in October, so we're confident that we will surpass that target and we will raise over 100% of what we've invested in the team this year. Going forward, we, as I said to you, that we want to be a professional team in the true sense of the word, and there are very few of them. So that's our goal, and I could look at my phone in the next 5 minutes and we could have a yes from somebody, or it may not happen and it might be 2018. We've got one company, a big global player, who has already said they'd like to do some events with us next year with a view to doing co-title sponsorship in 2018. But, you know, you never know quite whether that's going to come to fruition or not.
Well, can I ask, you say that you're a bit surprised by the state of the sport and when you've been involved in other functions to do with women in sport, because I'm quite heavily involved in any kind of promotion of women in sport. And I mean, from my point of view, there's such disparity between any female sport and male sport, generally speaking, barring maybe tennis and a few others, probably not even a few others. What surprised you? Because I'm sometimes surprised that people are surprised.
I may have lived a sheltered life. I've got two sons, you know, and having daughters, I guess, would raise your awareness of these inequalities. But it's not only in sport, though, is it? It's, you know, it's in the boardrooms, it's in business, it's, you know, it's everywhere you go. And one of the things that I've found really interesting is that I have to sometimes think and correct myself on some throwaway line that you might use. We've used the term girls a couple of times in this podcast, which I know there are people out there that will cringe and they'll think that that's wrong. But in my situation, I talk about men as boys. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I'm being disparaging in any way. But I can understand how certain people are. So it's little things like that that you're constantly thinking of, you know, trying to be politically correct. Yeah, so I'm learning all the time.
I mean, I personally think that's the death of feminism and equality when we're too politically correct. Because, I mean, who cares really what we call them as long as the intention is right and you're doing the right thing? Because I think, certainly if you look at any Twitter debates sometimes, people get bogged down in these tiny little details rather than thinking, well, where are we with the sport? You know, let's look at the macro side of things. And it's up to females and males to decide how they want to call their sex, really. It shouldn't matter, should it?
No, it shouldn't. And perhaps I'm becoming less worried about that as the years gone on. I was at one of the Women's Sports Trust meetings a couple of weeks ago, and one of the organisers came over, and we'd been having an afternoon discussion about their Man on Side campaign for next year. And she said to me something really nice that resonated with me, was that we're not talking about it. We're out there doing it, and that's nice.
Mm-hmm. I think that was sort of our founding principle with this podcast, Femina, that although we've not probably been entirely true to it all the time, but so much coverage about women in sport seems to be about the issues around women in sport rather than women doing sport. And I think really the genesis of this podcast was the coverage around the Shane Sutton sexism allegations, that this was filling pages and pages of newspaper that would never devote such space to covering actual women in sport. And that's been borne out since that. You know, I mean, when had Jess Varnish ever merited a story in a newspaper before she made these allegations about Shane Sutton? And so we wanted to try and counter that in a positive way, but not to dwell too long on that, because that would be to betray our founding principle of not getting bogged down in the issues. But Bob, you know, with the splash that you've made this year, the stories that you've generated, the awareness that you've raised, I know there's been a lot of interest in the team from riders wanting to join the team. You've had 150,
yeah, in excess of 150 applications,
including two men.
Including two men.
You
yeah.
haven't really been following the story that closely, have they?
No, they should be paying more attention. I suspect that I've sent that blanket email to more than just Drop Cycling team.
But you posted a very interesting thing on Facebook and on Twitter, asking people whether they would be willing to employ a former prisoner. And I was one of those who replied, along with lots of others, saying, yes, of course. But then you turned it around into the question of, would you as the owner of a cycling team employ or engage a former doper? And you've had some interest from, and this is something that you've now got to think about, isn't it? I mean, there were a lot of very thoughtful responses to that question, and clearly there's no clear answer to it, but what do you take from that?
I think I did think twice about posting it, but I did want to post something serious. So I tend to post a lot of quite flippant, funny stuff. So I did want to try to take on board some of the responsibility that comes with what we're doing. So I'm really pleased that I did. I learnt from it, that's for sure. I had my own opinions at the outset, which I think swayed this way and that, you know, as the responses came in. I was really pleased with the level of debate. I thought it was very grown up and articulate. And I think, if I'm brutally honest, and I had to draw a single conclusion from that, I would probably say that I'm a hypocrite.
In what sense? You wouldn't employ a former doper, you think?
I don't think I would.
Why?
Because of all of the arguments that were voiced in there, in the debate, that kind of swayed my opinion that people should have a second chance. And second chance in life and a second chance in sport, I think, are two different things. I think it's like everything in life. I think you would need to meet the person and hear the story firsthand and make your mind up.
Well,
but
yeah.
I think I would be more uncomfortable. Yeah, let's quantify that. I think I would be more uncomfortable employing a rider that's tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs than I would someone who had been to prison and served their time and would come into the business. Obviously, it depends what crime and the circumstances and what job that they're applying for.
Why is that? I find that really interesting. If the rider has served their time in a similar way to someone who's gone to prison, obviously they're very, very different. But if they are as contrite as someone who's come out of prison, someone who's come out of prison may not be in any way contrite. What's the difference?
I don't know. It's a really emotive subject, isn't it? And it certainly changed my opinion. I'm a great David Miller fan, and I like the fact that British Cycling have employed him as a mentor to the riders. I think he is very contrite, and I think he's almost evangelical in the way he wants to pass on the mistakes that he's made and make sure others that don't. But then, of course, his critics say that he, you know, says that he is making gains from that, you know, and he drives a Maserati, and there are a lot of people that are jealous if someone's got a Maserati, you know, all of these things.
Tell me about it.
Not Richard. Richard gets to drive a Maserati.
Yeah, but Tom raised an eyebrow and said, "Do you really want to open this can of worms?"
Tom being your son.
Yeah, and I kind of.
Who helps you run the team?
Yeah, he doesn't help me. He's co-owner of the brand and co-owner of the team.
You help him run the team.
Yeah, he is very quiet one behind the scenes who gets a lot of stuff done. I'm the big, tall, loud, bald one.
What
people want to meet in cafes and have coffee with.
What I mean, more generally, widening it out a bit, and you perhaps don't have that much insight into this yet, but the question of doping in women's cycling is there's often an assumption or something called good faith, which Daniel Freeb talks about in relation to teams, riders, but it applies maybe to women's cycling as a whole, that doping isn't a serious problem within the sport. Would you, in your limited experience so far, would that be complacent to take that view?
No, I think it's a fair reflection. We're very fortunate that we have a very experienced ambassador on our team, Moraine De Vries, who's a very good ear for these things. So I often talk to her about these issues. I think what really brought it out was that I met a rider in a hotel in France the weekend of Plouay that had sent us a CV. And there was no mention of her past. And I went to meet her in a hotel on the outskirts of Plouay where Team Sky were actually staying, bizarrely. And we sat and had a coffee. And I thought that she was a very strong candidate for a position on our team. And it was only when we got back and we did a bit of research on the internet that we realised that she had a failed test. So I was disappointed by that. And that really set the whole thought process going. So every CV that we have that we're now considering, we'll do a bit of research on the internet and a bit of a delve and, you know. But yeah, I don't think it's a major problem. So yeah, we shouldn't blow it up out of all proportion. I think it was more of a moral and ethical debate that you know, I kind of found intriguing.
Were you disappointed by the failed test or by the fact that she didn't mention it in your conversation? If she had been honest, would that have made a difference?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. She was a very charismatic, personable young woman.
That rules out Jenny Longo then. It wasn't.
Who I know here. You know, I know we have quite a large remit on age in our team. It's something we're quite keen on, but I don't believe we have a over 50s category just at the moment. But no, I was disappointed because she came over as a very outgoing person with a personality, a good personality. She had, you know, had some good results, probably lost away a little way. So yeah, I was disappointed.
Well, listen, Bob, thanks very much for joining us today. I'm sure we could talk to you forever.
But we probably will once the recorder stops.
We probably shouldn't at this stage, but I think we'll certainly follow the drop story with great interest, continue to follow the drop story with great interest, because it's fascinating to see a team, you know, start at ground level and build up, and especially some of the young riders you've got as well. Is that going to be... thought of another question now, having started to wrap things up, but is that going to be again the aim next year and even further forward, that you'll always be blooding some very young, very promising riders?
Yeah, we try to, if life speeds up and we kind of sometimes think we may be losing track of where we've come from, we will sit down and we do reflect on what our full goals were, and we kind of recalibrate ourselves. And we're going to sign 4 international riders this year, which we've announced 2. That was really important for us because we obviously see ourselves as wanting to develop. We wanted to offer an alternative to British cycling, to the track program, international road races, which without going into that, I think we can say we've ticked that box this year. So we've signed Lizzie Holden, up-and-coming young British rider, who I think is already very accomplished, and we think that she has a great career ahead of her. Obviously, we've already got Alice Barnes, who's had a phenomenal this year with a top 10 in a World Tour race. So we wanted to keep her. She's super ambitious, but she knows that we're also ambitious. So we've signed Susie Zorzi from Lotto, who's a classic specialist. She loves the Tour of Flanders. So we promised Alice that we would get her a experienced domestique for that type of racing. So we've signed Susie. We've also signed Martina Ritter, who's 34 years of age. So she kind of fits in with our older group. I think we've got five girls under 21, five under 27, and five under 35. So we think that that balance still works going forward. So we still have a couple of more spots on the team. But before anyone sends CVs in, we're all
woman
done with
only.
CVs.
Or like get off your phone.
I was just thinking, could I squish in?
We have agreed with one rider, which we can't announce yet, which is quite a cool international rider. I think will have quite an impact. And then we do have a last spot, which we've got two riders that we're looking at, but we think we've probably made the decision on the last spot in the pub last night. So
great. Well, good luck. And as I say, we'll follow it with great interest. It's really, it's fascinating to watch how it develops. So
it's been really interesting talking to you as well. It's lovely to hear that voice from inside the professional peloton.
Yeah, we'll get you back.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you do get, or I don't know if her CV's arrived already, but I was out cycling with Orla on Saturday doing my first ever women's sportif with Dame,
in training for his CV to be submitted to
with Dame Kelly Holmes. Orla was quite impressive until she went down a hill sideways, locked her back wheel on.
My
it was like cycle speedway. Anyway. We were there and we were doing some interviews and that will feature in the next Cycling Podcast Femina. It'll be a special episode on riding and training. We've got a report from a women-only training camp in Girona, run by, I think, your ambassador.
Maureen De Vries.
I believe so.
Yeah, and her partner Frank, fiancé, I should say.
This was the first women's-only training camp they'd run. So one of our colleagues was there and... she sent us a dispatch from there, so we'll have a report on that and also the women's sportive that Orla and I did.
My near-death experience / superior bike handling.
Yeah, it was
skills.
Very impressive. We were also here, Orla, weren't we, a few weeks ago an evening of talks about women's endurance cycling and the transcontinental race, things like that. We did an interview with Emily Chappell there, and that will be in a future episode as well.
Exhausting to even contemplate, but wonderful stuff.
Oh, it was very,
I saw that
very
on social media. It was very well supported.
Very interesting. A packed house here. Yeah, it's good. So anyway, that's all for this month. Thank you very much, Orla.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Bob.
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.